Good morning and welcome to this July 2nd, 2014 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. I'll give you more information on that in the second half hour. I'm your guest host, Marie Stone, and as always, Writers on Writing is dedicated to the art and business of books. Each and every week, we are here with authors to talk about craft, content, and the oh-so-mysterious writing process. It's my pleasure to welcome back this morning Lisa C., and in the second half hour, novelist JoJo Moyes will be here to chat about her novel, One Plus One. Lisa C. is the New York Times bestselling author of Dreams of Joy, Shanghai Girls, Peony in Love, Snowflower and the Secret Fan, Flower Net, which was an Edgar Award nominee, The Interior and Dragon Bones, as well as the critically acclaimed memoir On Gold Mountain. The Organization of Chinese American Women named her the 2001 National Woman of the Year. Her latest novel is China Dolls. It's published by Random House, and it's the subject of our chat this morning. Lisa, hi.
Hi, it's nice to be back.
Welcome back. You've always been such a great supporter of our show and our speaker series, and we so appreciate that. So welcome back. Welcome back. I'm going to give you a chance to introduce China Dolls to us, talk a little bit about the inspiration for the novel and kind of take us into your world and tell us about these three women.
Okay, so China Dolls is about three young women who meet at an audition at the Forbidden City nightclub in San Francisco in 1938. This was the nightclub era across the country, and in San Francisco there were Chinese-American nightclubs that billed people, you know, their performers as the Chinese Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, the Chinese Frank Sinatra, the Chinese Houdini, the Chinese Sally Rand, the Chinese fill in the blank. And when they would go out and travel around the country to other clubs, when you did that, you didn't say we're going out on the Borscht Belt or the Chitlin Circuit. You'd say we're going out on the Chop Suey Circuit. So this, you know, China Dolls follows three women from their audition through the end of the Depression, World War II, and then those years just immediately following the war.
Tell me a little bit about what inspired these women. Did these, I was wondering if sort of your writing begets more writing, and if as you're writing other novels, you're thinking about these women, or if they come to you sort of in different ways?
Oh, all of those.
Right.
So I think with this particular novel, there one of the things I had really wanted to write about was the idea of three friends and how different that is than just two friends. That, you know, even NASA did a study where they looked to see how to send people into space and discovered it didn't matter if it was men or women or a mixture, that you should always send two instead of three, because two will inevitably gang up on one if you send three. So my mom is in a group of three friends since seventh grade, so I've seen how on any given day one of them is on the outs.
Right.
So I really had wanted to write about that. And then I had been thinking about these performers and this era for a very long time. People often write to me through my website and will send me photos of their mothers, grandmothers, fathers, uncles, grandfathers, who were performers. And those photos and those stories, I don't know, there's something about how the photos are so glamorous, and yet the stories themselves often have a lot of hardship in them. So I think, and then last, I went and interviewed several of the performers who are in their 80s and 90s, so really the pioneers of that world. And I did think about it for a long time. I always do. I mean, I think a long time before I decide, oh, yes, this is the novel I'm going to write. So, like I said before, every way you suggested is all worked into
this. That's how it happened, yeah.
Book.
How did you find these performers?
Well, in a variety of ways. So, one, Maryong Tom, who lives in Tucson, I interviewed her when she was 93. She was still teaching jazzercise. And I had gone to Tucson to give a talk at the Tucson Book Festival. And, you know, one of the questions was, what are you working on next? And somebody who was there mentioned it to someone else who said, oh, you know, there's someone in our senior center who teaches jazzercise who was a performer. And she wrote to me, and that's how I found her. The Chinese Ginger Rogers, who's actually Japanese, Dorothy Toy, she was 93 when I interviewed her. She's 97 now. And a woman, I had just mentioned something on my Facebook page, and a woman wrote to me and said that she was actually in this group called the Grand Avenue Follies. And these, the Grand Avenue Follies, composed of people who came into the nightclub scene later, you know, like late 50s, early 60s, mm-hmm. and now have a kind of nostalgia group, and they go and play at senior centers and things like that. And she saw this mention that I had made on Facebook, and she said she was in the Grand Avenue Follies, and she also knew Dorothy Toy. So, you know, I hopped on a plane and went up to San Francisco and interviewed all the people in the Grand Avenue Follies, and they brought along somebody who'd been a costume designer at the Forbidden City. Mm-hmm. So, it, you know, it's ways like that. And then lastly, I was very lucky to be given some oral histories that had been done in the 1970s. So first, the Museum of the Chinese in the Americas did an exhibit on the nightclub scene, but with a focus on the China Doll nightclub, which was in New York. And they had this wonderful collection of ephemera, you know, menus, drink lists, scrapbooks that had belonged to a woman named Jadine Wong, costumes, movie clips, and as well as they had done a big oral history project. Well, about 15 people, I would say, all of them gone today. And they'd never transcribed them, but they let me use them. And then another man, again, just kind of coincidence, where he was the executive director of the Angel Island Immigration Foundation. And we had worked together on many projects, Eddie and I, but I had never mentioned what I was working on. And someone else told him what I was working on. And when he had first graduated from college back in the 1970s, he wanted to write a play about the nightclub era. And he went again and interviewed about a dozen people. He never wrote the play, but he called me up one day and said, I know what you're working on. I want to send you all of my transcripts, all of my interviews. So I had not only the people that I was able to interview myself, but I also had access to these wonderful oral histories that no one had really used or seen before.
It's amazing. That's amazing. You you mentioned earlier your Facebook page, and I was going to mention this later in the interview, but it's worth noting that it's so neat to see these. You have a picture of the cocktail lists from that era, and you have pictures of the women and, you know, all kinds of great artifacts that I think social media that, you know, I have resistance to some parts of social media, but I think it's great to keep the conversations alive about the novel and to bring aspects of the novel alive that otherwise might not, you know, might otherwise be lost on the reader who can't, you know, through just book and reading it, can't see these photographs and can't see the, you know, the cocktail menus. All of these things are just really wonderful ways to keep the discussion going.
Right. And also on my website, I have something called Step into the World of the China Dolls.
And, right.
And there it has clips of interviews with the performers, clips from when they were in movies and things, so you can actually see Dorothy Toy dancing. Just wonderful, wonderful stuff. I always say to people, you know, you can go in, you'll think you'll be in there for about 5 minutes, but 5 hours later you'll still be looking at things. And I do think that that is fun for people. And I know from my previous books that readers are inspired to go and look up things and find out more about, I don't know, foot binding, Nushu, the secret writing system, different things. So if I can gather that stuff together and just make it a little easier for people, you know, I've already done the work anyway for myself. I might as well share it with people.
Right, exactly. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest this morning is Lisa C. The book is China Dolls. I want to talk a little bit about finding the voices for these women. And rumor has it you wrote the entire novel from Grace's point of view initially.
That's correct.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about making the decision once the novel was written from her point of view, making the decision to go back and layer in the other two women and sort of voice discovery.
Well, and even before I'd written it just from Grace's point of view, the original version, of, I wrote about two-thirds of the novel in the third person. And then I went back and just felt, you know, I will feel more connected if I do it in the first person. So then I switched over to Grace. That was a big project. Mm. And then I finished all the way to the end. But when I went back to page one, and I really do write from page one to the end. I don't, you know, I know there are many authors who will get the first paragraph perfect and the first, you know, page perfect and the first chapter perfect. And I know that works for them. I could never do it. I just can't do it.
Right.
So I write all straight through to the end. And then I start over at page one. And there were places, even as I was writing it completely from Grace's point of view, where I could really feel Helen and Ruby just like elbowing, you know, trying to get their way in. They really had things they wanted to say.
Yeah.
And so as I started back at page one, every spot where I thought this Ruby needs to be heard now, thank you, and you know, she just really, you know, was just jumping out of those pages to be heard. So it actually was very easy then because Ruby especially, I think, had her own way of looking at the world and how, and her very own sort of unique language that she used. And then with Helen, you know, Helen is from a very traditional Chinese-American family. She uses all of those aphorisms that, you know, are so common, actually, in Chinese culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been collecting those aphorisms for years and years. I mean, I've got books of them, but I've got also a notebook that where I've been collecting them. And so, actually, whenever I would start her chapter, I would look for an aphorism that would set the tone for her.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sometimes it's the first line, sometimes it's just in the first couple of paragraphs, but it's something that really just set the tone and really where she was, what her state of mind was. And that was very helpful to me to create her voice.
Right, absolutely. How common is that, having so many novels under your belt? Do you find it common that you will write a novel entire, you know, the entire way through and then realize it either has to be told from another point of view or from first to third or from past to present? How many passes through, did this novel take more passes through than a typical novel for you?
It did, but I think it's partly because I had a new editor.
Mm, okay.
And, you know, I had worked with Bob Loomis for, I think, 5 books, so this was a big change. And I think we it also took us a little while, Susan and I, a little while to figure out how to work together.
Mm-hmm.
and what our common language was. I once had an editor long time ago. I was for my second book, for Flower Nest. He was a quite young guy, and the one thing that we had in common was Star Trek. And so when we would do the editing, he would say, remember that episode when Jean-Luc Picard went down to that planet and such and such happened? And, you know, don't you think that that's how David should be feeling right now? And so, you know, you have to find that language to work with another editor that works for the both of you.
I love that. I love that your language is Star Trek. That's fantastic.
Yeah. Well, with just that one editor. That's never happened again.
My guest this morning is Lisa C. The book is China Dolls. And so tell me a little bit about accessing, you're so wonderful at bringing the immediacy of the prose to life for the reader. And it's, I know the devil is in the details here. and bringing these both the time and the place so alive for the reader. And I was wondering, in San Francisco in the 1930s, which is when this is set, some of the biggest challenges that you encountered in trying to bring either time or place or both alive for the reader and getting all of those details just right and making it so rich on a sensory level for the reader.
Well, I'm a nut for research. And actually, just as we just before we started the interview, I was sorting all of my research for China Dolls to now, you know, finally put it away in filing cabinets. And, you know, there's so many different areas that I was looking at. Internment, Japanese internment, and very specifically Topaz. Restaurants in New York. I'm just looking at the floor right now where I have everything spread out. Nightclub coverage. Clothes, costumes. I'm just looking around here. You know, all of the war, invasion of China by Japan, Pearl Harbor, the international Golden Gate International Exposition, which was San Francisco's second World's Fair. So all of those things play into the novel. And you have to find out as much as you can. And I do tend to over-research. And to me, in the editing, that's when you start pulling out huge chunks. So in my first draft, I put it all in. You know, that's all stuff I found. I want to use it. And then as I edit, I just start to pull it out. And I think of it a little bit like, you know, that game Jenga where you build the tower and then you start pulling out the pieces.
Right.
And that you want it to still be solid. You know, and not tip over, but it's what you take out that, you know, is, I think, gives you a sense, but it's not a history lesson.
Right.
It gives you, and that I hope readers think, oh, if I ever ask Lisa real details about, you know, what it was, what daily life was like in Topaz internment camps, that I would be able to give them every detail.
Right.
But by just selecting a few, you can actually make that stronger and more memorable. And then with this with China Dolls, this was the first time I'd ever written so extensively about clothes. First of all, because they're performers, so they have all their costumes, and I needed to learn the language of costumes.
Right.
and those very particular costumes, you know, for nightclub dancers. But that period, 1938 to 1948, you have that end of the Depression, World War II, that period right after the war, where, and so, you know, the Depression clothes are pretty cheap because people didn't have money. And then during World War II, because of all of the shortages and restrictions, you know, clothes changed so dramatically from the 1930s. And then right after the war, there's a part of the novel where the women are now in Miami, and you have that huge influence from Cuba and that kind of Carmen Miranda look, big ruffled skirts and things like that. And then they end up at the very end, I don't think I'm giving anything away to say that they end in New York, and now it's definitely after the end of the war, the new look has come in, you know, the big influence from France. And so you can really see how just even in the clothes, you can visually transform people and move them through time.
That's really great. My guest this morning is Lisa C. The book is China Dolls. The other thing that's so lovely about your writing, and I think a real art, is your ability to build tension and when to disseminate secrets, when to, you know, show betrayals. And I was wondering how much of the details of these women's lives and their background is known to you somewhere in your mind before you start writing, and then as you're writing it all the way through, or are there secrets revealed to you and you are surprised during the writing process, and does that allow the secrets to be disseminated more organically to the reader? Tell me a little bit about building tension in the novel and how you do it for yourself and how you do it for the reader.
Right. Well, First, I think that there is something to be said about pacing and where things get revealed. And I think that's where, I wrote three mystery thrillers. And so I think that I've been really able to use that training that I got from writing those books to help in the pacing of these more, quote, literary novels. Grace's Secret comes out very quickly. Ruby's Secret comes out relatively quickly. But then there's still hidden depths to those secrets.
Mm-hmm.
And Helen's Secrets, those are pretty big. Again, I don't want to give anything away.
Right,
but
right.
There, I will say this. There's this one huge betrayal. I don't want to say what it is, but the one huge betrayal. Everything is revealed finally in the penultimate chapter. Who was the person who betrayed? I actually didn't know until I started writing that chapter who was the actual person who had committed that betrayal.
So great.
So some I have a sense, but some it's just I'm waiting. Okay, I'm going to get there and then it will all become clear.
Right, right. Yeah, I was going to ask you what this novel revealed to you that was surprising to you as writer. That what came out of it for you? What you learned from it?
You mean in just the process of writing?
Well, or even in the story, kind of psychological about human nature or about this time period, or if there was something not necessarily in how you advanced as a writer, but something about the storyline that revealed to you something about human nature or something about
right.
Psychology.
Well, I would say, and I guess it's something that recurs in my books, all of them, this sense of persistence and, people who had real hardship and yet were able to overcome it and still do what they wanted.
Mm.
And that really struck me, especially with the women performers, but even the men who performed at that time. They were going up against such incredible odds. And yet, I think today sometimes there's criticism of the performers, and actors of that era, even someone like Anna May Wong, that she's the one who created the dragon lady stereotype or, this China doll stereotype. But if you think about it, what other roles were there? There weren't a lot of roles for Asian Americans in film, and there weren't a lot of places if you were a dancer or a performer, singer, magician, acrobat, to go and perform if you were Asian. And so the very fact that they created a way for themselves to do that, and really kind of on their own terms. I just think it's very impressive, and especially given that they had really grown up, come of age during the darkest years of the Depression. So they all had just unbelievable hardship as small children, and yet had this desire to perform and what they would do to allow that to happen and make that happen. I just found it very, very inspiring.
Yeah, yeah. I read you said that when you're deep in the writing process, you don't dream. And I'm kind of captivated by that all of your imagination is able to be filtered through the page and it kind of drains it from your brain at night.
I think that's true. It's such a rest to go to sleep. And then when I'm not writing, I do have these just terrible nightmares. And actually last night I just had terrible, terrible nightmares. And my husband this morning said, you know what this means? You've got to start work on the next one. And it's true because it's much better to live in my imagination, I think, during the day than to let my subconscious go wild at night.
That's funny. That's funny. The demons come, you can't stave them off. I love that writing is the antidote for staving off demons. That's really cool. And I know you're a big proponent, as is your mom, of writing 1,000 words a day and how that takes and I think writing your novel straight through perhaps would do this as well, but strip the preciousness out of your, either, putting too much pressure on yourself to make every piece of prose perfect or, kind of taking off the...
And also that, you can't wait for that moment of inspiration. You hope that you're going to be inspired every day, but it doesn't really work like that. And so if you just get up and you sit down and you work, the inspiration does come in the work, but you can't wait for it to arrive. And so I think you're right, though, it takes away some of that maybe preciousness. But here's the other, just the practical side, and what I always say to people who want to write or are starting out writing, even if you can't do 1,000 words. I mean, for me, sometimes I can do it in 2 hours, sometimes it takes me 10. And I even keep a little notebook where I, you know, have the date and how many words, and I have to do the 1,000 when I'm writing. But I also always say to people, you could just start at 500 words. That's just 2 pages. Yeah. If you do 2 pages a day, at the end of a week, you'll have 10 pages. At the end of 2 weeks, you'll have a chapter.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just that little bit, little bit, little bit. And once you're in that, and once you have that as a habit, I think you're really kind of in a zone of thinking about your characters and thinking about their emotions. You know, we haven't talked too much about emotions, but, you know, how that drives the novel forward, as long as you're with them all the time, if they're really in your consciousness. And so even if it's just the 500 words a day, you'll find that when you're driving or in the shower, you know, that those characters and the emotions are they're all active in your mind.
Perfect, perfect. What a great note to end on. Lisa C., I want to tell people that we can find you online. You have a website, lisac.com. Are you doing any more book tours or moving around to promote the book, where people can find you in the world?
Oh, yes, and I have that all listed on my website. I still have quite a few events in Southern California. I'm down in, I have quite a few in Orange County just coming up, and I'm still traveling around the country a fair amount.
Yep, perfect, perfect. And we can find you on Facebook, and we'll check out your website to find you in real life so people can get a copy of this book signed. It's a really wonderful, wonderful read. Lisa C., thanks so much.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break, but please stay with me. Novelist Jojo Moyes will be here joining me from the UK for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We will be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org, and we are always available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We're under College Radio. You can always visit Barbara's website at penonfire.com for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series, events, and more. I'm your guest host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. I'm joined now by Jojo Moyes. Jojo is the New York Times bestselling author of 12 novels, including The Girl You Left Behind, Me Before You, and The Last Letter from Your Lover. She is also the author of the e-only novella, Honeymoon in Paris, as well as Silver Bay, on sale August 26th, and The Ship of Brides, on sale October 28th. Jojo also writes for a variety of newspapers and magazines. Her latest novel is 1+1, published by Viking, and just now out and available in the States. Jojo joins me live from her farm in Essex, England. Jojo, hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. I had a long, lovely conversation with your daughter. She sang me happy birthday.
So cute. Yeah, I think it was a little mix-up with the numbers, but yeah. I'm glad you got me.
Me too, me too. All right, so I'm going to let you take us into the world of 1+1. It's actually called The 1+1 in England. Is that, that's right, right?
Yeah, often there's a little bit of variation depending on what's already been in the market on, you know, in different territories, but we figured it's close enough not to confuse people.
Yeah, no, perfect, no, perfect. So take us into the novel. Talk a little bit about the basic storyline and what inspired these characters.
Okay. Well, it's a road trip essentially, but it's one in which I wanted to explore a couple of things really. In England, I don't know if it's the same in the States, but there's just been this growing gap between rich people and poor people, and it wasn't as big as it is now when I was young, and it's something that does concern me. And I was curious about the way that, you know, rich people really have very little contact with people who are on very low income levels now, unless they're kind of cleaning their houses or washing their cars or whatever. So I just thought, what better way for the two sides to have to confront each other's views and prejudices and see what they're really like and whether they have the same concerns than to car, right. You know, for a long time, very close together. And it's really, that's making it all sound a little bit more political than it is. But it's a story about families that don't quite fit in. It's a story about a single mum and her two kids and how difficult it is, even if you do the right thing, to get ahead if you're not born with certain advantages this modern day.
Right. I love these. I love journey novels. I think it affords so many opportunities, both for the writer and, you know, for the reader. It's a great, you're right. It's a very confined space. You're moving. So, you know, your setting is always changing. Mm. And you've got this compression of, you know, psychologies inside this car that are
absolutely
forced together. Yeah.
And the smallest things start making you a little bit crazy. Like there's a scene where when they're quite new in the car together, Jess, the young single mum, starts tapping. And it's the kind of thing that in normal life wouldn't bother you at all. But if you're having to put up with someone tapping next to you in a car for sort of 3 hours, is going to start sending a tick going in your jaw. And yet, you know, if you say it out loud, it sounds completely crazy. So I just, yeah, I had a little fun with it. The, as you say, the joy of road trips or any kind of journey is that you can explore some of the tensions, you can put them in different places, and, yeah, you can have a little fun with it, hopefully.
Right, right. As well as having to drive your car really slow because somebody's car sick. And
yeah. Oh, God, I'm so sorry if my phone's going.
No worries.
Yeah, exactly. Well, England is not as big as America, so we're sort of less well-suited for road trips, in fiction anyway. So I thought what I needed to do was to find a way to slow this down. And my sister, even though she's in her 20s, gets horribly road sick even now, and you have to drive quite slowly. So I thought, well, I might just borrow that trait and give it to a 10-year-old girl.
Right. I was wondering, so those are some of the advantages of writing journey novels. I was wondering if you encountered any disadvantages and how well you had to know their route and their journey, if you had to drive that route and journey to know, you know, what gas stations they're stopping at and some of these things.
Oh, yeah. Well, I didn't actually drive the journey because it's a long way and I have three kids and I just didn't think I could kind of manage that with, I didn't want to replicate the whole trip, but right. I did plot it out on a map and looked up all the signposts and the features that would be there. The beauty of things like Google Maps now is that you don't even have to be there. You can do that. What's that thing
right.
where they filmed everybody's houses?
Yes, right.
You can
exactly.
actually see what every street looks like, which, you know, I have to say, having been a slight critic of it before, I suddenly saw the point as a novelist when you need to see what an area actually looks like. But because England is a much smaller place than the States, a lot of the places I was writing about I had been to before, and some of them I fictionalized because I found over the years that if you write about real places, quite often people will stop focusing on the narrative and they'll start focusing on the fact that actually the post office has a baker next to the butcher, you know, and rather than the important stuff.
Right. Yeah. Right. So let's go into a little bit of these characters because these are wonderful, quirky, great counterpoint characters. And tell me a little bit about your process of discovering these characters on your own, kind of, you know, mining their personalities, finding their voices.
Well, I'm a character freak. I think people tend to divide quite neatly into plot or character, and I'm all about character. Before I start any book, I actually go out and I buy a nice line-free A4 hardback book and some nice pens, and I write a history for every single character who is going to play a significant part in any book that I write. So I want to know where they came from, what they look like, what their parents did, what's their motivation, I don't know, how they eat, what foods they like. And, you know, I put them through various tests. Like I ask if they were to come down in the middle of the night and raid the refrigerator, what would that be like?
Hmm.
Because often those tests tell you a fair bit about your character without you realizing, you know, is there any food in the fridge? Do they come down naked? Do they never eat? Do they eat compulsively? I have another one called the kick the dog test, which sounds worse than it is. But I put the character into a situation where they see somebody kicking a dog, and you have to ask yourself how your character is going to react to that. And that's surprisingly telling because it tells you whether they're someone who's brave, who thrives on conflict, who doesn't, who's empathetic, you know, all those things. So over the years, I've just found it's useful to kind of Yeah, run them through a few tests, really, and then you find that by the time you start writing, even though you may not use any more than 5% of that total information, you have a very clear picture in your head of who each of these characters actually is.
Do you keep notebooks on them as you're doing these
exercises? Oh, yeah, you have to refer back.
Right, right.
You can't kind of hold all the information in your head.
So great. Who gave you the most?
I can't, anyway.
Yeah, I know. Well, I couldn't either. I can barely hold the information in front of me in my head.
Tell me about it.
And who gave you the most trouble? Was there a character in here that was most difficult to access for you?
That's an interesting question. Well, not for the reasons that you think, but the dog gave me the most trouble because I wrote him and I deliberately didn't want to write a kind of anthropomorphic dog. I didn't want to write a cutesy, sentimentalized dog. I wanted to write a dog a little bit like my dog, who is flatulent, ignores most of his instructions, affectionate, but actually not really good for very much. And so I basically upsized him to something vast and slobbering and frankly a bit revolting to anybody but the most ardent dog lover. And I was writing a crucial scene in the book in which he gets hit by a car. I don't think I'm revealing too much. And it was about 11 o'clock at night, and I'm a big fan of Twitter, and I just thought before I went to bed I'd just say what I've been doing. And so I said, I'm just finishing writing chapter whatever it was. Can't decide whether to kill the dog. And I turned my phone off and I went to bed. And when I woke up in the morning, there were about 100 messages on Twitter just saying, do not kill the dog. And it was extraordinary because I was thinking, A, you haven't read this book, and B, it's a fictional dog. But people really, really care about fictionalized animals. And the funny thing for me was, shortly after that, having thought, gosh, people are strange, I was reading The Goldfinch, and there's a small dog in it called Popchick.
Yep.
And I found myself getting really anxious about what was going to happen to Popchick. And then I realized that, you know, I was doing that exact same thing.
I've heard from readers and writers over and over that you just can't kill animals in fiction. People get so, you can kill people, no problem.
Yeah. But it's so true. I recently had an email from a reader who'd read a book that I wrote some time ago called Ship of Brides. This book's about 7-8 years old. And in it, a dog dies. And she wrote to me and said, I'm a huge fan of your book, but I have to tell you, I will never read another one of your books after what you did to the dog.
Right.
And I had to think for about an hour how I was going to respond to this email. And in the end, I said, well, you know, you're perfectly within your rights never to read another one of my books. But, you know, all I would say is my own animals are very healthy and happy, and it was just a fictional dog.
Right, right.
But, yeah, I agree. You don't mess with the animals.
Don't mess with the animals. My guest this morning, is Jojo Moyes. The book is 1+1, and you raised a good point, which was Twitter and social media. And I was talking in the first half hour with Lisa C. also about social media and how it keeps conversations between writers and readers alive in very interesting ways. And I know you've done Goodreads conversations with your audience. But using social media as a way to keep the book alive in the world so that it's even more of a conversation between writer and reader, and what the advantages and disadvantages are from your perspective of that.
Well, for me, it was a huge advantage for a long time because, 3 or 4 years ago, my books were not...
Are you there?
No feedback apart from... To seek you out just to say, I just want you to know I love your books, is an amazing thing. And it is interesting when people give you their opinions on characters, and you know, the greatest compliment a writer can have is that the character comes alive in the imagination of somebody else. So when people start telling me what they think Will should have said and done, or Lou should, or you know, any of the characters, it is an amazing compliment. The hardest thing I found as the books have kind of sold bigger and bigger and bigger is actually keeping up with the conversation, because until quite recently I've considered it a matter of honor to respond to pretty much every tweet that somebody sends me, because I feel like if they've gone to the trouble of buying my book and reading it, the least I can do is say thank you. But it's getting quite hard to keep up, and you know, I really want to, but it's tricky.
I was going to say that probably is one of the disadvantages, is that it's so difficult. I mean, now you're spending all of your time responding instead of writing the next novel, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that's the point at which you have to ask yourself, you know, can you carry on with this? Like, I know one writer who I won't name, but who is kind of world famous, who doesn't have a contact button on his website because he found that he was getting so many requests from people, readers, who just wanted to explore different aspects of character with him. And, you know, did he think that such and such did this? Why did he do that? And yes, I have a lot of that too. I don't think I have as many as him, and I don't think I found it as intrusive as him. I actually don't mind the conversation, but the logistics of it is becoming a problem, yes.
Right, right. Your books take on a lot of heady subjects. The last was assisted suicide. This one has issues of bullying, obviously the class issues that you mentioned. And but they arise seemingly very organically. And, it doesn't seem like a political book, certainly. But these are just issues that people in their lives encounter. And I was wondering if when you set out to write, you have sort of these big issues in your head that you're interested in grappling with, or if, in fact, they do arise pretty organically.
No, that is exactly it. I tend to find that the thing that you're likely to write best about is the issue that's niggling away at the front of your brain. So when I wrote a book about assisted suicide, it was at the time that I had two relatives who were in need of 24-hour care. And at the moment, I'm interested in the issues of, you know, bullying and also poverty, because it's how what I see in the society around me. And I have two teenagers and another child, and I'm interested. I hear a lot of what goes on in their schools and among their friends. And I think you write best about the issues that are concerning you. And I don't think you have to be a so-called literary heavyweight to cover those issues. I think that there is a place in commercial fiction to cover very serious issues, as someone like Jodi Picoult has shown, you know, dramatically well. I think perhaps the difference with me and Jodi Picoult, apart from the fact that she's obviously been a mega-selling writer forever, is that I found that if kind of the darker the topic, the easier readers find it if you leaven it with a little bit of humour, some of the light stuff. And, you know, in my own life, I don't know if it's a British thing, but there is a lot of dry humour. We laugh at a lot of dark things, and I suppose it's our way of coping. But, you know, that's what I try to reflect in the books that I write.
Yeah, I think that's a human characteristic. If you don't have humor,
it's like
really
the emergency services always have the best jokes, right?
Right, exactly. My guest this morning is Jojo Moyes. The book is 1+1. Let's talk a little bit about the process. You've had so many books under your belt and you're so prolific. And I was wondering if there is a scene on your journey that you know some pivotal thing is going to happen, do you restrict yourself from just writing from beginning to end? Or do you ever write ahead and, reveal things to yourself that out of order? Or tell me a little bit about your structural process.
Mostly I don't. Mostly I'm pretty rigorous about going from A to Z. But I have once written a book where I had to write the end scene first because it was a slightly audacious ending, and I needed to know if it would work before I wrote the rest of the book. And it was quite an emotional ending. And what became quite odd about writing that book is that I had to keep writing towards it and rereading it. And I would make myself cry every time I reread it. And because I read it first, by the end, I think I must have cried a million tears while writing this one book. But in general, no. I try to iron out any problems as I go along, because otherwise I find that you slightly don't want to. And also, if you have twists ahead, you sort of need to know precisely where everything goes in your plot. And I do like to have a twist or two. Yeah.
Do you kind of outline after the fact, after you have everything written down, do you then go back and look at it, you know, in outline form, or kind of what does your office look like?
Well, I have two whiteboards, one in my kitchen, which is meant for me, but actually my kids just scribble all over it and insult each other and write down how much pocket money I allegedly owe them. And then I have another one in my office, and I use the whiteboard to plot out major points in the book. So, for example, where do the lead characters meet? Who is up at one point? Who is down? Where do the kind of climactic moments of the book take place? Because I think it helps to see the shape of the book in your head. And then what I do is I tend to write a rough plot so that I have maybe 15 rough chapters in which certain points have to happen. But what you find is that when you get going, obviously some things take much longer. So sometimes, I've written the death of a character and found that the book actually took much longer to get over it than I had anticipated. So you had to actually have an extra chapter of grieving, for example. Some writers have to see it and some have to hear it. And for me, it's a seeing thing. I need to see the shape of it. I need to have the title of the book over my computer and possibly any major theme, so that basically I ask myself a question every day: what is this book really about? You know, what's the major thing underpinning this? And that's helpful for me to keep coming back to, even if the plot is kind of weaseling away somewhere away from me. If I can keep the theme in my head, then it tends to stay on track.
Right. Were there big surprises that came out of this book for you not necessarily in the writing process, but big things, anything that was surprising that was revealed to you about the characters or about life and psychology, or, you know, something that the book told you that you didn't know before you started it?
I guess in a way, sometimes you learn stuff from your characters, weirdly. Me Before You was about assisted suicide, but also about the business of really living, you know, when you have the chance. And that made me a lot braver about, for example, flying again, which I hated and avoided like the plague for sort of 20 years. And now I'm pretty much flying everywhere. And I've had this amazing couple of years because of that. In 1+1, I really had to confront my own tendency to catastrophize. You know, I'm one of these people who always has to have an escape plan, who needs to know what's the worst case scenario, and then I can get out of it. You know, not necessarily that dramatically, but, you know, say the car fails, where's the nearest garage? I'm that kind of a person. Mm-hmm. And Jess is such, who's the main female character in the book, is such an irrepressible optimist. And it actually works for her. And as I was writing, I was thinking, why aren't I more like this? And I think it's actually made me determined to be more optimistic and easygoing about things. I don't know if my husband would agree, but that's that's how I felt.
I love that. Writing is therapy or something.
Yeah, it definitely is. Often you write a book and then you look at it a couple of years later and work out that actually you were processing a whole heap of stuff that you hadn't realized at the time.
Right. That's so great. My guest this morning is Jojo Moyes. We've run out of time, but I want to mention that I just missed you. You're on your way to Southern California, and we couldn't get you onto the show when you were here. I know.
Maybe next time.
Next time. There'll be more books. But I wanted to mention to people that you are Monday, July 14th at Warwick's in La Jolla at 7:30 p.m. Tuesday, July 15th, you're at our very close by Mission Viejo Library at noon, and Vroman's up in Pasadena at 7. And people can find you online. You have a lovely website, yes.
And I will do my best to respond.
Yeah, you don't have to respond. But but anyway, you can find Jojo on online, and you can find her around Southern California in the weeks coming up. And Jojo, this was such a huge pleasure. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Jojo Moyes. The book is 1+1, and she will be here. It's out in the States and available now. Nicole Nelson will be here with you next Wednesday morning, and stay tuned. Melanie is coming up with Into the Coachella coming up next on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Thank you so much for joining me. Have a great day.